Welcome back, everyone, to Politics and Polls. I'm Sam Wong, your host. I'm a professor of neuroscience, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium and the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. I'm very pleased to have as our guest today Lawrence Lessig. Professor Lessig is Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. Prior to rejoining the Harvard faculty, Lessig was a professor at Stanford Law School, where he founded the school's Center for Internet and Society, and he's also been at the University of Chicago. He's clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and the late Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. The author of numerous books, Lessig has received many awards, including the Free Software Foundation's Freedom Award, Fast Case 50 Award, and he's been named one of Scientific American's top 50 visionaries. Today, we're going to be talking about elections and how they can be made better in America. It's a real pleasure to have Lessig on our program today. Larry, there's just so many things I want to talk with you about, and I will say that I'm going to take the view of on some areas, I'm going to sound like a total layman, and on the other areas, I'm going to sound like a total nerd. And so if it's okay with you, I'll take as our subject matter today how elections are run and how they could be possibly run better, because I think that's been something that's on your mind a lot. What do you think about that?
Well, I think absolutely. First, you're right. It's been on my mind now for more than a dozen years. And in the dozen years that I've been focused on this, I feel like I've found increasingly fundamental reason why this problem exists. And as I see it now, I think the fundamental reason is we've allowed our institutions to betray the fundamental principle of a representative democracy, namely that it be representative. And so whether that's money in politics or gerrymandering or vote suppression or the Electoral College, they all are aspects of the same flaw. They all fail to hold the institution up to this very simple but fundamental principle that we ought to be representing people equally.
And so when you say representing, getting away from that, I mean, as far as I can tell, there are simple principles that could be used to build a good system. And we seem to be caught in this history-dependent corner where we've had what the founders wrote, what interpretations have been of those original documents. And now we have interests that in some cases have would like to undermine parts of those rules and not others. So it feels like just this very history-dependent corner we've ended up in. Should we take these, should we start with perhaps campaign finance?
Sure.
Yeah.
We can start anywhere. It's the same story in each of them.
Yeah. In the case of campaign finance, I'm curious, things have ended up in a place where with the McCutcheon versus FEC decision, maybe we should perhaps give people a sense of where things are at right now with the financing of elections. It feels to me like campaign finance is essentially less and less fettered. So where do you see the state of play being right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good exercise. Let's see if we can summarize this in a simple way. Beginning in 1976, the Supreme Court has articulated an increasingly simple jurisprudence. And so the beginning of that jurisprudence said, Congress has a sufficient interest to limit corruption, where by corruption they mean quid pro quo corruption. So anytime what we've got is actual quid pro quo or the appearance of quid pro quo, Congress gets to regulate it. And quid pro quo means basically this for that. So it's basically the idea behind bribery. So the first question that was asked was, can Congress limit the amount of money you give directly to a candidate? And the court said yes, because unlimited contributions to a candidate directly either are or can be reasonably seen to be aspects of quid pro quo corruption. So this upheld the aspect of the Campaign Finance Act at the time that was limiting contributions to candidates. But the second half of that was, well, can you limit expenditures by political campaign committees? And the court said, well, that has nothing to do with corruption, expenditures. When I spend money to buy an ad in the New York Times or 30-second television ad on CBS, that's not corrupting anybody. So therefore, you can't limit that political speech because it's not corruption. So that meant that you could campaigns could cost unlimited amounts of money, but you had to raise money for campaigns in these tiny chunks that were regulated by this concern for corruption. Okay, all that's about the campaign directly. Then there's a second set of questions, which are about activity independent of the campaign. And even in that first case of Buckley, the court had to answer the question whether a rich person could spend unlimited amounts of money uncoordinated with the candidate, not tied to the campaign at all. And again, from the perspective of quid pro quo corruption, the court said, yes, they can spend whatever they want, because if it's actually independent, as a matter of logic, independent means there's no quid pro quo. So if you're actually spending your money independently of the campaign, then there's no corruption justification for restricting your spending. And so rich people are constitutionally free to spend whatever they want to support or oppose a political candidate as long as they don't coordinate. Okay, that was Buckley. Then fast forward to 2010, the case Citizens United.
Yes.
Where the question was, can Congress restrict corporations from spending their money independently of a political campaign? The court has already said you can't restrict rich people, but what about corporations or unions? And the court said basically the same thing. Well, if the spending is really independent, then that's not going to create any risk. That's not corruption. And if it's not corruption, that means that Congress has no power to restrict it. So that meant not only rich people, but corporations and also unions could spend unlimited amounts of money. And the final little tweak is the case that you were talking about, McCutcheon. So in the Buckley case, the court said, 1976, the court said, Congress can limit the amount you're giving an individual congressperson because they're trying to avoid actual corruption or the appearance of corruption. But the question of McCutcheon was, okay, if you can limit the amount I give to one congressperson to avoid corruption, can you limit the number of congresspeople I give that money to? So I might be able to give $1,700 to a congressperson, but could I give $1,700 to every congressperson? And the court said, well, if it's not corruption at the individual level, it's not corruption when you aggregate all those individual contributions. So you can give the maximum amount to everybody if you want, which basically meant that what they didn't realize but was pretty obvious was going to happen. You have these rich people now who basically make a $10 million contribution to some entity who then splits that $10 million contribution up into smaller contributions that then get shifted where the parties need them, whether that's in New Jersey or in Michigan or whatever. So it's a nice way to get around the limitation on individual contributions, but it all follows from this very simple logic. If it's corruption in the sense of quid pro quo, Congress can restrict it. If it's not corruption in the sense of quid pro quo, Congress can't restrict it.
And so just from a naive point of view, there's a certain logic to that. If donations to an individual candidate are not corrupt, then why would donations in the aggregate be corrupt? So one could make a principled argument that said, if you believe the first thing, then this McCutcheon decision flows out of the previous work.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay. And so now what's the limit that any person can give to a campaign? Something like $3.5 million?
Yeah, it's some ridiculous amount. I don't remember what the current number is. And there are these committees, these basic coordinating committees that the parties have set up. So they basically talk to the rich people and they say, write your check for whatever, $3.5 million. And we will channel this where we know it's going to do the best. And it's not just, you can channel it not just to candidates' primaries campaign. You can also channel it to their general election campaign. You can channel it to their victory fund campaign. You can channel it to the local party. You can channel it to the state party. I mean, there are lots of places to channel it. But what everybody knows is that those people who are writing those $3.5 million checks, those are the most important people in the political process. They're the people who get every single telephone call to any senator or president answered. They're the people whose policy concerns are the most important to the parties and also to the candidates. And they therefore are the unequally represented citizens within this so-called representative democracy.
I see. So getting back to the fundamental principle of representing people equally, this is a violation in the sense that the rich and the poor have the equal right to sleep under the bridges of Paris.
Exactly.
And so now we have a situation in which if you have $3.5 million, you get all your calls returned. So what are examples of entities? I mean, I don't travel with U.S. senators and I don't travel with national parties. Who are the ones who feel the most beholden to these donors?
So it's basically the party structures, especially in presidential election campaigns, that become the most beholden. I had a student who basically worked in one of these. You know, she was basically the one coordinating the for the Clinton operation, coordinating these large contributions to make sure they went to the right channel. I mean, she was working for the party, but it was in the Clinton election. And you know, she was quite open about the way in which you just knew who you had to listen to and who was the most important. And of course, again, these people are not stupid. They don't ever engage in a kind of crude bribery. Nobody says, okay, I'm going to write you this check for $3 million if you veto the following two bills or if you propose the following tax cut. But you don't have to be that crude, right? I mean, everybody's sophisticated enough to know what everybody's interested in and know that they better be delivering in a way on those interests if they want to be able to count on these people the next time around. And so that's what produces this influence, which is just not going to change.
So describe for me, how could one, are there political actors now who escape this? You know, we hear about Bernie Sanders only focusing on small donors. We hear similar statements from Elizabeth Warren, your colleague or former colleague, I suppose. How can a candidate or any elected official escape the influence of these large donors? Is it possible?
You know, I think at the presidential level, absolutely it's possible. You know, I actually don't think the problem is as pronounced at the presidential level. So, of course, I think—
Because you know, they have access to many millions of dollars, and so therefore, like, even the largest donor gets kind of, like, lost in the crowd?
Partly, but it's also because, you know, the business model of being a successful president isn't about sucking up to every tiny little, you know, person with money. It's about, you know, vision about what you're going to accomplish as president. So I would wish we would have a system for electing the president where the president wasn't dependent on private money at all. I mean, the biggest reason for that wish is the comparison between Barack Obama's reelection campaign and Ronald Reagan's reelection campaign. You know, we forget that every president between Nixon and Barack Obama was elected with public funding. Ronald Reagan benefited from public funding more than any other president because he ran three national campaigns on the public's dime. But when he ran for re-election, he attended, I'm forgetting the exact numbers here, but he attended something like 28 fundraisers. Barack Obama, when he ran for re-election, attended something like 228 fundraisers. And so, you know, it's not that I think that Barack Obama was in every little corner worried about what this guy wanted or that guy wanted. But certainly if you're thinking about how do I successfully run 228 fundraisers, you're going to be worried about, you know, the interests of what rich people care about more than what the interests of the average American care about, at least for the purpose of raising money. But my point is, that's not the real problem. The real problem is Congress. If we don't change the way Congress raises its money, then it doesn't matter what the president wants to do. Everything significant the president wants to do, if we live in a democracy, actually has to go through a representative body called Congress. And so if, you know, if you look at Obamacare, so Obamacare had two critical compromises right at its core. Number one, there was no public option, even though the president promised a public option, said he would not sign it without a public option. There was no public option. And number two, there was this incredibly grotesque deal made that said that Medicare was not allowed to negotiate for lower drug prices.
Oh, yes.
So Walmart can negotiate for lower drug prices. My university can negotiate for lower drug prices, but the government can't negotiate for lower drug prices. Both of those compromises were made because the insurance companies and the drug companies could basically tell the Democratic leadership, look, if you don't drop these things into the bill, then we will spend tens of millions of dollars to defeat Congressman X, Y, and Z. And what that means is you're going to lose control of Congress. Now, of course, the Democrats lost control of Congress anyway. But the point is, it's Congress where the real details to policy get set. And if we don't have a Congress that's free to make decisions based on what it thinks is right, as opposed to what the richest people in America demand, then we're never going to get the kind of reform we need on healthcare or student loan debt or climate change or any number of issues that we know we've got to have a Congress that can deal with sensibly.
And congressional campaigns are run on the scale of these days $1 million and so, or whatever, millions of dollars. And so what that means is that a donation, say, I don't know, if a zillionaire gives a few thousand dollars to somebody at that level, that's starting to get noticeable.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, and these people who channel money, you know, it used to be that the billionaires didn't really matter so much to Congress people because they didn't waste their time. But now, of course, they've become essential because this channeling function becomes a really effective way for them to be in the mix of giving money to Congress people too.
What do we know about how this plays out in state legislatures? It seems to me that I was just reading about this. I was looking at Texas. I mean, this is just a random example, but there's 150 members of the Texas House. That means that it's about five times as many districts as congressional districts, so the districts are smaller. Texas legislators, as it turns out, get paid about $7,000 a year because it's a part-time legislature. So don't these influences get even worse at the state level? Are there people tracking this? And is there a sense of how this plays out at that level?
It's much cheaper at the state level. And so, yes, it's much more pronounced. You know, like the state of Kansas, the Koch brother network spent, you know, a relatively small amount of money. I think it's in the order of like $3 to $5 million. And we're basically able to secure control of that legislature. And then that legislature, with its governor, proceeded to do some of the dumbest fiscal things they could possibly do, radically cutting taxes, believing that the Laffer curve would kick in and they would raise more revenue.
Oh, this is Sam Brownback and his I mean, it was a sort of a laboratory of democracy where they took those ideologies to their extreme and basically seemingly drove Kansas into the ground.
Absolutely. And but of course, all of that, the wheels for that were all greased by the fact that the legislature had been basically set up and could be set up for relatively small amounts of money. So this strategy of like moving down has become central, not just in the kind of, you know, substance like tax cut policy, but even more importantly, in the area that you've done so much work on in the context of gerrymandering, because obviously controlling the legislatures every 10 years becomes a really critical part of the strategy for gerrymandering. And so in 2010, obviously the Republicans with Project Red Map were so good at figuring out how to deploy resources to make sure they would secure control so that they could then deliver on a very powerfully gerrymandered nation.
Right. So this principle that you say of equal representation, there's this thing that it lurks in my mind, which is that speaking from a scientific point of view, if we think about systems where you have biological feedback or a thermostat, any engineered system where there's feedback to keep things from running out of check. If I turn down the thermostat, then if it gets too hot, then the cold air kicks in. And so in some sense, voter sentiment is a feedback mechanism to hold legislators in check. It's the mechanism for holding legislators in check. And so when we get to the point of people who are drawing the lines, it seems to me that a major weakness in our democracy is state legislatures, which are small-time operations in the sense that the campaigns don't necessarily cost a lot of money. The districts are smaller. And so one could, through focal action, get a pretty large result simply by focusing money on some races, getting control of that state, and then drawing the lines as one likes, and then creating an advantage that then persists and then insulates those districts from the influence of voters.
You know,
close the feedback, and then there's no way to break the feedback loop, and those people can, that party or that entity can basically keep itself elevated in the air indefinitely.
Yeah, and there's very little that Congress can do about that at the state level. But many people forget that Congress has explicitly in the Constitution the power to protect its own districting. So Congress could pass a law tomorrow that required independent districting commissions for Congress or eliminated single-member districts and created like ranked choice voting in multiple-member districts. I mean, there's lots of things Congress could do to solve the problem with Congress.
Right.
And I think they should, but it's all to this end of making sure that the essential, I mean, it's the other half to the core principle that I said was representative democracy. Democracy's got to be representative so that the accountability function can work. And what you're saying is there's no accountability function as long as you have this distortion in the districting.
So I'm trying to figure out how to escape this. I'm thinking about this, if Congress is beholden to these powers, You've advocated at one point the Citizen Equality Act. When you, I don't know if listeners know this, but you ran for president of the United States in 2016, and you were very focused on election reform. I would interpret your candidacy as a message candidacy, where you were trying to get people focused on campaign finance reform and electoral reform legislation. Would that be an accurate way of thinking of what you were doing that year?
That's exactly right, and I'm glad you remember the act, because what I still am kind of proud of in that act is that what we said was change the way campaigns are funded. Number two, end gerrymandering. I wanted to do it through multi-member districts and ranked choice voting. Number three, restore the Voting Rights Act. I mean, make sure that you have protection. Everybody has an equal freedom to vote. But the critical thing was this package together was necessary to create equality and representation. And that package is very close to what Congress passed in the beginning of this year, or the House passed in H.R. 1, which I think was the most important reform legislation that has passed Congress since the 1965 Voting Rights Act. You know, that was public funding of congressional elections, like I was saying, gerrymandering reform, like I was trying for, though different form, and a promise on the Voting Rights Act and ending of vote suppression. It's this package approach that I think is critical. And we have to build the movement to recognize how it's a mix of reforms that have to happen all at once, because you can't, if you do it in piecemeal, you give the other side the opportunity to, like, you know, take you on. It's like, you know, if you've got a very severe infection, you're going to have to have a massive response if you're going to be able to attack it. And that's what we have to have happen here.
Well, let me take a cynical view, which is that it was free to cast a vote in favor of H.R. 1 because there was no chance it would be taken up in the Senate. So let's say, hypothetically, best case scenario for reformers would be to vote in the party that voted for H.R. 1, which is the Democratic Party. And let's say that they get in. Do you think that support would still be there?
I think the only way it happens is if we get a presidential candidate who says, reform will be the first thing I do, and my package of reform includes these essential elements: public funding for congressional campaigns, gerrymandering reform, vote suppression reform. Now, you know, seven candidates have basically said they will make democracy reform the first thing they do. The substance of that reform is not yet where it needs to be. I mean, you know, Mayor Pete Buttigieg has said that, but we don't yet have fleshed out the kind of reform it needs to be. I think Elizabeth Warren is going to say that with the right package of reform. But I think that, you know, we should recognize that if a candidate is elected with this commitment, there's a significant chance that it happens. So, you know, that might be just 10% or 20%, but that's an order of magnitude more likely than any time we've seen in the last 30 years. So I that's what leads me to be relatively optimistic here. It's going to be a fight. We haven't yet won with the candidates, but we're certainly in the line on the direction of winning with the candidates. And that, I think, creates a certain kind of momentum that, you know, if the president of the United States is a Democrat and the House is controlled by the Democrats and Mitch McConnell is not controlling the Senate, it's going to be hard for the Democratic members not to do what they ostensibly did already in 2019.
Let me keep on being kind of negative here. I want to be pushed back on here. What happens when these things collide with the Supreme Court? So we've got a post-Citizens United world. You walked us through what happened with Buckley, what happened with Citizens United, going through McCutcheon. We've now got this framework of jurisprudence that says money is speech and you got to leave it alone. So can these laws survive challenge in the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. So the Supreme Court has basically said you can't restrict speech, but it's also said you can certainly fund it. So the very same case that Buckley versus Vallejo that struck down expenditure limits and upheld contribution limits also upheld presidential public funding, voluntary presidential public funding for sure. But it said, you know, there's no reason Congress can't create a system where people opt into public funding so that they don't have to raise money privately and create the impression that they're dependent on the private interest.
I see.
So what's happened historically is that, reformers have tried to get reform on the cheap, have tried to get reform by suppressing speech. And though I think the decisions of the court restricting that are not correct, I do think we've just got to suck it up and pay for a democracy. You know, it wouldn't be that expensive relative to the value of actually making it so we didn't have Congress people who are sucking up to rich people in order to get to Congress. They could just be sucking up to voters.
And I see.
That's the way democracy is supposed to be.
Right. So find ways to finance more speech and level the playing field in that direction.
Well, never use those words, please. It's never about leveling the playing field.
Oh, is that bad?
And this is a really important point.
Yeah, okay.
It's about ending the dependence of Congress people on this tiny fraction of the 1%. When you start saying leveling the playing field, you make it sound like what you're trying to do is to create a world where everybody speaks equally or there's like equality in speech. And you might like that. It might be a good idea. Canada has a principle like that. But that is the core principle the Supreme Court has said is not allowed. It's not about leveling, but it should be about making it so we don't have these Congress people who are dependent on, you know, a tiny fraction of the 1% in order to be in Congress. That's the corrupting influence that we have to find a way to address.
How much of this can be done at a state level? Is there a route? I mean, I've really been channeling my inner federalist lately. The Supreme Court has just made me really think more and more about the merits of doing these things at a state level. Are there routes to doing this through voter initiative or through state legislatures?
Some of it. Certainly the gerrymandering reform, though, again, I think Congress should just do it directly.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't really fix the funding of congressional elections at the state level. Mm-hmm. That's going to require federal legislation. And though the states could, in principle, like stop suppressing the vote of the politically non-favored party, which is basically what this is in most cases, I think, there's little incentive for them to do it right now. So I think there, too, you need Congress to create the right incentives, which they would if Congress, were committed to the simple principle of citizen equality.
Well, I guess at the state level, one could imagine doing things through voter initiative, couldn't one? I mean, like, I don't know, financing of state level elections. So something like what you're saying, but within a state. So I don't know, hypothetically, I'm not sure what state I'd pick. I don't know, Arkansas or Colorado or Michigan. Citizens could bring an initiative to do some of the things you're talking about, couldn't they? At the level of state legislatures.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, places like Michigan have already seen incredible reform done through the initiative process.
Yes.
But again, it's a reform of the state legislature. It's not a reform necessarily of the federal legislature, although the districting commission that Michigan has set up will district Congress people as well as state legislature.
Yeah, well, that was what fascinated me about the passage of independent redistricting commissions in Michigan, Colorado, Arizona, and California, and then different versions of reform, where basically there's this way in which state legislatures can keep themselves in power that's made far more difficult by interposing independent citizens or different kinds of commissions that take the power away from legislatures. And so just legislators. And so it just strikes me that breakage of the feedback loop, even though it doesn't address the congressional representation problem it doesn't address the beholden nature of congressmen to donors, but in that case it does address this endless loop of dependence of legislators on previous legislatures and so on.
Yes, that's right, and that removing improper dependence, I think, is a really key way to make it possible for them to do the right thing.
I want to hear your thoughts about where things stand on another aspect of this. As you say, you have a whole suite of reforms that are very important. I want to hear your thoughts about the Electoral College. That's obviously on a lot of people's minds these days, and you've attacked the current mechanisms of the Electoral College in various ways. Through lawsuits, through proposed legislation, what do you see as being a plausible path today to addressing problems with the Electoral College?
Yeah, so I feel like I've spent a huge chunk of my life now wrestling with this, and so here's the view I've come to. The first important thing is to recognize what the problem is. The problem with the current system, because of winner take all, is that there are only about 12 or 14 states that matter in the election.
Right.
Those are the so-called swing states. And if you're a candidate, either a Republican or Democrat, it could make no sense at all to spend money trying to persuade people from Texas or California or South Carolina or Massachusetts to support your campaign. If you're a Republican, you wouldn't spend money in California because you're never going to win enough to get a majority. If you're a Democrat, it would make no money to spend. It makes no sense to spend money in California because every dollar you spent is wasted. You're going to win anyway. So that means that the only states that matter are the swing states, and those states are not representative of America. Again, this is the same point, not representative. They're not representative because they're older, they're whiter, their industry is not representative of American industry today. You know, they're like something like 7.5 times the number of people who mine coal, who work on solar energy as mine coal in America. But you never hear about solar energy because those people live in Texas and California. You hear about coal mining because those people are in swing states. So the key is to make it so the president cares about either all of America or at least a representative sample of America. And the only way to do that is to think about changes that make every vote matter. Okay, well, the simplest change that people are talking about, the one that doesn't require a constitutional amendment, is the National Popular Vote Compact.
Yeah.
And what that says is states basically say once a majority have agreed, a majority of electors, not a majority of states, but once a majority of electors are committed to this, we will pledge our electors to the winner of the national popular vote, regardless of who wins in our state. So if, you know, a Republican gets the most national popular votes, then California would pledge its electors to vote for the Republican, even though the Republican lost in California. That would be a kind of nice hack or a way around, hack around the Electoral College to basically mean that the winner is the winner of the national popular vote and the Electoral College doesn't matter anymore. I think that solution is constitutional. I'm increasingly clear about how the other side will argue that it's not constitutional.
It's got the word compact in it.
Yeah, right.
And the Constitution has a thing about compacts, doesn't it?
Well, it says that many of these compacts, a compact technically is supposed to be ratified by Congress. There's an argument this one doesn't have to. All of those are really details to the, you know, the question. It's either the court will uphold it or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And I can understand why it's possible the court would not uphold it. If the court doesn't uphold it, then the question is, what should happen? I think actually the most interesting cases we've got right now are cases that are actually trying to answer the question whether electors have to vote the way they are pledged. You know, there were 3 electors in Washington State who voted against their pledge in 2016, and they were fined $1,000 each. There were 3 electors in Colorado who wanted to do the same thing. They were threatened by the Secretary of State. So we've actually taken cases to try to resolve this question, because regardless of which side you are on this, you should agree with us that we should resolve this before it creates a constitutional crisis. So we're trying to get the case up to the Supreme Court. I'm pretty confident that the court will take our case this year, and we'll get a chance to get the court to resolve it. I think the more I look at this, it's really hard to imagine the Supreme Court concluding that electors can be bound to vote one way or another. It's just completely contrary to the idea of what electors were.
The original idea that electors were supposed to deliberate in some way.
Yeah. So especially for this conservative court, which says that, you know, they're just reading the Constitution. So if you imagine the Supreme Court in like January or February or maybe March coming down with a decision that says, oh, and by the way, electors are free to vote their conscience. They can do whatever they want.
Uh-huh.
My sense is America would say, what the hell are you talking about? This is a completely crazy system. And if in fact that was the reaction, then we'd be looking for the kind of change that both sides could be okay with. And so here's what I think is the kind of change both sides should be okay with.
Yeah.
The Republicans think that they like the Electoral College because they think it benefits small states. It doesn't. It benefits swing states. And, you know, Pennsylvania is not a small state. But that's why they think it's important. They think it's a thumb on the scale to benefit small states. Okay, well, here's a system that would benefit small states in the same way, but would also be much closer to one person, one vote. Imagine you just basically say every state gets a number of votes equivalent to the number of electors that they now have. So you basically get a vote for every representative plus 2 for senators. That would still give electors in small states, small states more power than big states, because Wyoming has 500,000 people and it gets three votes in the Electoral College, which is 66 times the power of California, but okay. But if instead of voting winner take all, they said these electors have to vote proportionally, and not just proportionally, these votes have to be cast proportionally, and not just proportionally, but fractional proportional. So, you know, down to like the tenths of thousands, maybe even the hundred, I don't even know what the number would have to be. So that, you know, I would get, so a candidate might get 1.4476 votes from the state of Wyoming.
I see. So electors are now like stock shares. Like you can have fractional ownership.
They're fractional ownership.
Uh-huh. All right.
If that were the rule, then the right would be getting the idea that Wyoming has a thumb on the scale relative to California. But the left would get the idea that every single vote would matter. Because if you're a candidate running for president, you don't care where you get your fractional vote from, you know, Wyoming or Pennsylvania or California, it's a vote to vote. So you would have an interest in making the pitch to everybody in the nation, and that would make everybody relevant, and that would get us closer to the ideal of one person, one vote. Uh-huh. So if you ask me what's the most likely amendment that could actually get agreements on both sides once you've motivated them with the crazy reality that, in fact, electors are free, I think that's it.
Pardon my injection of power politics into this, but seems to me that the thing that's really going to need to happen to power reform here would be for a Republican candidate to get more votes but lose the Electoral College. It seems like that would be kind of helpful here. Like, let's say,
Donald so close to that in 2004.
Absolutely, with Bush versus Kerry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If 50,000 votes had switched to Kerry in Ohio, then Kerry would have been the president, even though Bush would have won the national popular vote. And if that would have happened, you're exactly right. There's no doubt we would have had this fixed by then, because then people would realize this wasn't a Republican scheme. It was equally stupid for both parties.
Yeah, I got to say, this whole business about smaller states, smaller population states having more power just doesn't strike me as the biggest problem. A collaborator and I have done numerical simulations looking into all the different ways that coalitions can form and letting regional vote vary. And as far as we can tell, any time a presidential election is within 3 percentage points in the popular vote, in other words, if the vote is 50-47 in the popular vote in one direction or the other, then there's a 1 in 3 chance of a miscarriage of the Electoral College, in the sense that there's a 1 in 3 chance in either direction that a Democrat would win the presidency but not the popular vote, or a Republican would win the presidency but not the popular vote. And that it so happens that right now in 2016 and 2020 looks like there's a little bit of an advantage for the Republicans given the way that the coalitions have gone. But as you say, gosh, just even a decade ago, it could have been the other way. I think that's a hard thing for people to grasp cognitively, because actually it's been Republicans who have benefited. And so then what do you do? Like, you know, gosh, you know, a Republican would say, I don't know, it worked for us in 2000. It worked for us in 2016. You're just a no good liberal trying to whine about the fact that you lost the presidency according to the rules as written.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although again, I think that the conclusion that electors are free destabilizes everything.
I see. So you see that as being helpful in force, it's a enhancing contradictions or something.
Absolutely.
All right. Okay.
I mean, who's going to accept that? Who's going to accept that? And so if you are a congressperson who doesn't vote to amend the Constitution after that, you know, it's a hard position to be in, because I don't think anybody could be really okay with that system right now, even though I think that's clearly what the Constitution requires. So let the people decide if they want to continue what the Constitution requires, because that's what that decision would force.
Well, let's see. So if it works, it's like one of those zany TV show premises. If it works, we'll eat like kings. And so it does seem like a tough shot, but it does feel like a way to move towards change. So,
I mean, I think that's right. And I also think it's the only plausible, destabilizing shot right now, because I think people have settled in pretty good around the existing system, however stupid it is. And so here's a chance to get them to rethink it and you know, maybe change it.
Well, look, we're almost out of time here. Just your general sense. We're here in 2019, and we've got an election season coming up. What kind of things are you looking for, or what kind of things are you hoping for citizens or advocates to push for in the next, I don't know, in the run-up to the election and maybe even a little bit after?
I think every citizen has an absolute moral obligation to force these candidates to commit one way or the other on fundamental democratic reform. And that means to get them to say, are you going to make this a day one issue? And if it is a day one issue, what are the elements of fundamental reform? And if we can just get them to rally around that idea, you know, to adopt the way Buttigieg has like made it, this is what he said, first day, democratic reform. If we could just get that as the frame for who the next president is, then when he or she is elected, having made that pledge, then I think we have a shot to getting them to do it. So this is, I think, our job right now. You know, people are obsessed about the difference between single-payer healthcare or healthcare with a public option or Obamacare with a public option. Those arguments are meaningless, totally meaningless arguments right now. And rather than like obsessing about things that could never matter, given the system of corruption that we have right now, we should be focusing on getting the system of corruption fixed. And then it might matter whether we're talking about single payer or a public option or anything else that people are talking about. So I think the only way this changes is if we do our job as citizens to focus those politicians and the obscenely absurd media that like drives questions to them to ask the right questions and give us the answers that we need. And that I think if we could do that would actually begin to make the changes happen.
We could wish for that media. I think the media are not trained in democratic principles of what constitutes a good democracy. Media, you know, there are reporters who are trying to get a job done and their job is defined by their fellow reporters. And if they're obsessed with, you know, email hacks or differences in in healthcare policy or whatever it might be, then they're not going to focus on this. I have to say, to my taste, I would love to see campaigns run on issues that appear to me to be at the heart of our democracy, such as equality of representation or, let's say, climate change, large threats to either our nation or to our entire planet or to, you know, not just our species. Like it just feels like there are some pretty large issues that are more important than, say, I don't know, whether and how Kamala Harris eats a pork chop at the Iowa State Fair.
Yes. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I want us to focus on what makes government possible again, because I think climate change and healthcare and, you know, the future of work are incredibly important issues we need to be able to grapple with sensibly, and we can't, given the corruption that we have right now. So somehow we have to get them to the right place, and, you know, we all have to do our job.
It is an unusual time in which even ordinary, sensible steps forward require extraordinary commitment from all citizens. So we can all work towards that. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this program. I really appreciate you taking the time.
I'm grateful that you would ask me. Thank you, Sam.
All right. Okay, that's it for another episode of Politics and Polls. Thank you all for listening. Julian Zelizer and I will be back with you for a future episode. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. And if you have any questions or comments for either me or Julian, you can send them to politicspolls@princeton.edu. That's politicspolls@princeton.edu. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.